The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome. You know, Jackie, this is a favorite time of year for me. You know why?
Really? February?
Yeah, because, you know, it's already the days are getting longer. I'm sensing that the light is coming up much sooner in the morning and setting later. And at this time of year, it really starts to accelerate. It's also sort of the first signs of spring and things start to warm up. But that's not what we saw in Texas.
We're actually here in a lot of North America was covered by this terrible cold spell.
Yeah,
it got down as far as Texas.
The polar vortex and so on. And we're going to talk about that today. And I'm really excited today. We've got two real experts on electrical power and also what happened down in Texas. So there's a lot to talk about. I'm going to jump right into it and introduce our two guests. Straight on the line from Texas is Joshua Rhodes. He's a research associate at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also an independent consultant at Idea Smiths, LLC. Welcome, Joshua.
Thanks for having me.
And a colleague of his here in Calgary, Blake Schaefer, assistant professor in the Department of Economics at the School of Public Policy, University of Calgary. Welcome, Blake.
Hi, Peter and Jackie.
Good to have both of you. So we've got a lot to talk about, and I know both of you co-authored a piece recently about the situation down in Texas, and I know our listeners are eager to hear about the consequences, what's going on down there, even what it means to Albertans.
So you did co-author that piece. We will put a link to it. It was published in the CBC, Lessons for Alberta from Texas Power Blackout. So just to give context, I'm sure not too many of our listeners missed this event. You know, we had this exceptionally cold weather in Texas, and it really was worse on February 15th and 16th. For example, Dallas, which isn't so far from Austin, temperatures were about minus 10 to minus 14 Celsius compared to the average temperature, which was more like plus 15 Celsius. And because of this, people demanded a lot of electricity, more than the power system could supply. And the operator of the electrical system was forced to cut production and, I guess, cut demand by having these rotating blackouts. And it was a really serious situation. Reports of, you know, hundreds of people having carbon monoxide poisoning because they were combusting hydrocarbons, you know, in their garage and poorly ventilated places. People did die from the cold. There's shortages of safe drinking water. And natural gas production was curtailed, so there was even issues accessing natural gas for those that could use natural gas directly. So we're going to talk about all of this. We're going to talk about the situation in Texas and also some learnings from Alberta. But first, let's hear from Joshua. How have you been coping? How was Austin impacted, and what's the situation now?
This event really showed us where a lot of our vulnerabilities lie in our infrastructure. And it's not just the gas infrastructure and the electricity infrastructure that you mentioned. You know, it's the cascade on effects have now gotten into our water infrastructure. We couldn't clean up enough water, and so we had to do water boil notices. And it's just been a big mess. Not to mention that during the event, we don't have snow plows down here or salt or gravel or anything like that. So to compound on that, we couldn't even go anywhere during this event. You know, we lost power for about 40 hours. We were told it would be 45 minutes, ended up being about 40 hours. You know, it got pretty chilly in the house. Yeah, it's been a tough and trying time, I know for me, and then I know for many of my fellow Texans.
You know, from afar here, we just sort of watched in awe. You know, we're used to the cold over here, but down there, the pipes were also freezing and so on and so forth. But let's get right to the energy issues. Can you tell us sort of what happened as the cold weather hit? We get sort of bits and pieces about the wind turbines freezing and the gas pipes freezing and power plants going down. But give us a play-by-play.
So it's helpful to understand that, you know, our grid down here in Texas, you know, is built for the summer. You know, most of our resource adequacy planning and all of that type of thing are built around 4 p.m. on August afternoons when every single air conditioner in this state is operating at the same time. And the levels of electricity that we serve during that time are actually greater or, in some cases, somewhat comparable to what we were expecting or what was forecasted to have been served had we been able to had serve it here last week. And so we're used to serving that amount of electricity. The difference this time was that about half of our power plants run off natural gas. And the difference between this, I mean, in the summer, there's no competition for that gas. And so homes aren't wanting hot water. They're definitely not wanting heating. We don't even want to cook down here. At that point, we're all barbecuing outside. During heating events like we had last week, about 40% of homes use natural gas for heating. And so while there was a massive pull out of the natural gas system for power plants and for heating, we simultaneously had a constraint on the supply. So we had a lot of wells that froze out in West Texas. They could not put more gas onto the system. And so we ended up not being able to move that gas to the power plants. And in some cases, the power plants couldn't provide electricity, got cut off to booster pumps for natural gas systems. So there's all these interconnectedness between the natural gas system and the electricity system that we don't normally see in the summer that we saw now. Plus, we had a bunch of cooling water issues freeze up in our other thermal fleets like nuclear and coal, as well as we did have some icing on some of our wind turbines.
Having studied the numbers myself, I mean, winter on average in the United States is about three times as energy intense as in the summer, especially when you have it in places that are not winterized, such as Texas. I also understand that because of the summer demand that you prepare for, that a lot of the units were also under maintenance. They were down, a lot of the power generators.
That's correct. Like, we had a large number of our power plants going into the event or the day of, about 14,000 megawatts out of roughly 80 to 90,000 megawatts were down for maintenance.
You know, another complication, I think, is that Texas, a lot of people still use electricity for heat, right? So the demand went way up. Like, I think the electrical system operator forecasted that demand was going to be up like 35% or something like that from typical. Is that mainly due to heating?
Yes, about 60% of homes in Texas use electricity for heating, but it's not like the efficient heat pump style. It's mostly the old school or the old style electric resistance heating, basically a big hair dryer. And so it's not very efficient at creating heat, particularly down in the very southern tip of Texas that almost never sees these types of temperatures. As soon as they got cold and all of their heaters turned on, I mean, that's when really the demand shot through the roof.
You're not winterized, but there's also stories of border cities bordering, say, Louisiana, where they didn't have this problem. So give us the difference between what happened in, say, Louisiana versus Texas.
Louisiana had some issues a little later on in this event, but the Texas grid, or the ERCOT grid, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, is wholly contained within the state. And this grid serves about 90% of load inside of Texas, and it only has very weak ties to other grids. We are basically an island of electricity when it comes to grid, and that's unique. Other states are more well interconnected. Texas is the only one like this, and so we were not able to import, you know, meaningful amounts of energy during this event. And some of our border cities that are on those other grids, they fared better in some cases than our main core cities.
All right, we'll get into some of the learnings and differences between Texas and other jurisdictions like Alberta. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit about the finger pointing that's going on. Like, there are some people that are saying that this issue is a result of an over-reliance on green energy. And I will refer to a chart that is in an IEA report that we'll put a link to this in the show notes. And it shows up till February 16th where all the generation was coming from in Texas. And it's kind of interesting. Prior to this event, wind was contributing a fair amount. And some days it was as much as a third to half of all of the generation in Texas. And then when we got into this cold weather, 90% or more of the energy was coming from natural gas, coal, and nuclear, which stepped down a little bit, was still there contributing. So what does this tell us about the need for baseload non-interruptible power as we think about going to a world where maybe we rely more and more on wind and solar, and it maybe isn't available in these extreme events?
That's a great question. When we plan for these kind of winter events, we don't plan on all resources being there all the time, particularly wind and solar. Obviously, we know the sun's not shining, you know, at night, or it could be cloudy during the day, and the wind's not always blowing. And so the grid operator, when they were looking at what do we think will be there during this time, they were only counting on wind to be meeting about 10% of our demand at that point. So we already weren't really relying very much on wind. Now, there's some parts of that wind during this event, this multi-day event, that wind did better than that. In some cases, it did worse. In fact, Blake recently just tweeted a great graphic showing all of the different sources and how they fared. We do need to, as we look to decarbonize systems, we need some firm, dispatchable, low-carbon generation. I was trying an analogy on Blake the other day, and maybe this will work. We'll see how well it goes over in Canada. But I was looking at wind kind of like flip-flops. They don't keep my feet very warm in the winter, but I don't throw them away because they're useful in Texas 9 months out of the year. But I need to make sure I have boots for whenever it does get cold outside.
It's helpful to think of two constraints we need to solve. One's an energy constraint. So we need some quantum of energy over some broad period of time. And renewables are pretty good at that. They can deliver cheap, clean energy over a broad period of time. The other one is a capacity constraint. At any individual moment, we need supply to at least equal demand. And we can't rely on them to any meaningful degree. And like Josh pointed out, in the reliability assessment for winter, ERCOT relies on about 7 gigawatts, or they expect about 7 gigawatts of wind at any time. They have a stress case scenario where they rely on about 2 gigawatts. Over the period of the blackouts, wind produced roughly 4 gigawatts, less than expected, a little bit more than the extreme case. What they do rely on for capacity in the winter is the thermal fleet. They rely on about 67 gigawatts. And so while natural gas and coal and nuclear, like you pointed out, provided the bulk of the energy during that period, that was expected. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they ended up providing less than what ERCOT actually expected them to be able to do. And in most cases, other than nuclear, less than even the extreme case scenario.
Yeah.
And so it's important to sort of separate, when we talk about reliance, separate the notion of capacity and energy.
So it's easy to throw out these numbers in gigawatts and hard to wrap your mind around exactly what it means for our listeners. You know, I'm struck by, as I look at these charts, the sheer amount of energy that a state like Texas consumes. What I'm getting at here is that some people say, well, we just need to install more batteries, new age batteries for storage. But if you look at, say, the 7 gigawatts of wind that's expected, 7 gigawatts available over the course of 5 days, that's just a huge amount of energy. I mean, do you realistically think that batteries could fill in for thermal?
My take on that, and this is something we talked about in our lessons piece, is there is an important conversation on what provides that firm capacity when renewables aren't available. And storage is certainly one of them. But as you point out, the quantum makes it challenging in Texas. Those are huge numbers, 7 times Alberta's load, for example. But I think the bigger problem with storage is most of the storage we're looking at is really good for hour-to-hour, intraday fluctuations. This is the type of storage that's being deployed now. It's really good for solar, managing intraday solar changes. It's not good for a week of low wind, which is something we saw in ERCOT, but it's also something we face here in Alberta. The cold temperatures that we lived through, you know, last week and the week before are synonymous with periods of low wind. So multi-day storage isn't very effective at this point in time. So some of the suggestions we have, things like expanding the scope of the transmission grid, expanding interconnections, imploring more demand response. And then, of course, looking at peaking capacity that is climate resilient, which was one of the things that failed in ERCOT, was they had all of this capacity on paper ready to go. It simply failed at the same time as demand exploded because it wasn't prepared for the extreme weather.
We'll get to some of those specific recommendations. I would just add, Peter, you know, it was much bigger than that. The electrical system operator had to shed 27 gigawatts of demand. So imagine if you're trying to back that up with batteries, like that's like more than all the power consumption of a city like Tokyo, equivalent to something like 13 large nuclear power plants. Mm-hmm. And what happened to the price in Texas on the 15th and 16th?
If there's any blackouts, then the price in the market is just pegged at that $9,000 a megawatt hour, because if you're having blackouts, there's definitely scarcity in the system at that point.
So Joshua, the average person in Texas, all they know is they got this multi-$1,000 utility bill. And not only that, they didn't get any power and had their pipes frozen. So how is that being reconciled in the state?
Because there are private companies that customers contract with to buy their power from, there are some of these private companies that offer wholly pass-through rates. And so you pay basically a membership fee, maybe it's like $10, and then you get whatever the wholesale market's clearing at. And most of the time, that's worked out great for customers, because the average wholesale market price in ERCOT is around $30. And so instead of paying 12 cents a kilowatt hour, you're paying 3 cents a kilowatt hour. But during last week, when prices go to 9,000 a megawatt hour, that's $9 a kilowatt hour, which is a lot higher. When we've seen some of these reports of these bills that are above $10,000, that's generally customers who were able to opt into these plans. They made the choice to opt into these plans. The majority of customers are on fixed rate plans. So I think there won't be as much of those kind of bills in the immediate term, But obviously, utilities and retail electric providers are needing to make up losses that they may have had in this past week. Prices will go up somewhat.
Well, and it got me thinking, and I'd be interested in Blake's comments on this, that as we go towards more wind and solar, that's where everyone wants to go, are we going to have much more volatility than we've had in the past? And what's that going to do for people's acceptance of these technologies, but also for investment? The prices are going to be a lot more volatile. Sure, you can make some money on those good days, but there's probably going to be a lot of down days too. And that may slow down investment in some of these.
So there's two kind of sides to that. So one on the customer side of things, like Josh pointed out, the $10,000 bills and those people on flow-through rates is the exception, not the norm. By and large, most people are on a rate that's fixed, if at least for the month, if not longer. And that's certainly the case here in Alberta, where no residential or commercial customers are on base the actual pool prices. They're on some fixed notion. So we can shield them from the hour-to-hour volatility that's going on within the actual market. Here in Alberta, you can lock in for 5 cents for 3 years, for example, right now. But on the market side, you're absolutely right, Jackie, with more renewables on the grid, with a zero marginal cost of production, that means you're going to have kind of a bifurcation of what the clearing prices will be. You'll have periods of very low prices when wind's abundant or solar is plentiful. And then you're going to have periods of relatively high prices when those aren't there and you're having to go up the supply stack to find something to keep the lights on. And how that affects reliability depends in large part on the market models behind them. So on the regulated side, the regulated utility goes out, determines what they need to maintain a certain level of reliability, they make their case in front of the utility commission, and then can flow through those rates on an average cost basis to consumers. We don't have that. So in the deregulated case, there's two models. There's the ERCOT and Alberta, which are similar. Basically, you get paid for what you generate, and the incentive to be there when there's no other supply is very high prices. So a lot of volatility, a lot of risk, but you avoid the potentially costly side of things for consumers of having to pay for things you don't need. We saw the fallback on that in ERCOT this week where they simply didn't have enough because it wasn't weatherized. But that's what we do. We sort of put blind faith in the market that people will come and rush in. And if there isn't enough supply, we'll have enough periods of these high prices to bring in more supply over time. In other deregulated markets, they have what's called a capacity market layer added on top, which is a payment, typically an annual payment, sometimes multi-year. And that's simply for stealing ground. It's for having a power plant that simply can produce, whether it's producing or not.
That's sort of like a spare generator in the background, right?
Exactly. You're simply paying for that extra generator to be there in case you might need it. And when it produces, they'll get some energy price revenue from that. But the energy revenue is going to be a smaller component for them than it would be in an energy-only market.
So it's like sort of like an insurance policy against this sort of volatility and increasing climate volatility and that kind of thing.
That may be something to be considered as we move to a slate of power that is more intermittent, that we put in capacity factors, which we don't have in Alberta. I do think that was actually talked about at one point under the NDP government, right, to put that in as they were considering a greater amount of our energy to come from renewables. Is that right?
It was. It definitely was. They had planned for a capacity market under development by the grid operators who runs our market. And then the current government, based on consultation with industry and other folks, decided against that and stayed with the current market design we have. To be fair, the jury's still out on whether or not a capacity market is the best market design, even in grids with increasing shares of renewables. I think that's a far too wonky, detailed discussion to go into than we want to have here today. But it's not even clear. I think Joshua and I have had this discussion. It's not clear to us that the capacity market would have saved ERCOT from what occurred down there, unless receiving a capacity payment was coupled with a requirement to hit some sort of winterization engineering spec. The types of penalties typically associated with non-performance in capacity markets aren't often to the $9,000 per megawatt hour incentive there was in ERCOT to be ready and available. So right. I'm not entirely sure that market design was the flaw here.
And I was thinking a little bit about Alberta. You know, you talked about in your article about our concern is actually the heat and that with a change in climate, it may be that we get temperatures in the 30s and 40s, which actually we do experience already, maybe not as many days as we may have in the future. But my thought was there, well, isn't that at a time when let's assume we're putting a lot more solar in Alberta, which I think we are going to. I think there's a lot of plans to put a lot more solar in. Doesn't that correlate nicely with the solar producing a lot of energy during our peak?
Absolutely. So solar helps on the energy front seasonally in the summer. Of course, with solar, you have this intraday problem where, you know, California's named it, they put a name to it, they call it the duck curve, when solar generation is starting to tail off in the evening, right as load starting to ramp up in that evening, and you have this really big draw on dispatchable generation. That's something, though, that batteries can deal with quite well. So that is something where there is a solution. I think our commentary on the summer in Alberta was really speaking about ERCOT being prepared for their summer, their peak season, being ill-prepared for winter. Here in Alberta, it's the opposite. We're really well-prepared for winter. We just set a new load record 2 weeks ago, and there wasn't even a blip of an emergency on our grid. We are well set up in our gas and electricity systems for that. In the summer, you know, what Peter made that comment earlier, it's not a period of peak draw in energy. We don't have the heating load, so we're not going to have as large a gas load. But we perhaps need to think about whether or not our infrastructure is rated for the potential thermal loads that could exist in summer that Texas is prepared for, has cooling water at the ready. Are we prepared for that in all aspects? So it's not a problem that is impossible to overcome. It just requires a little bit of cost repair and some engineering foresight.
Yeah, so what you're saying, Blake, is that our grid here in Alberta may not be able to handle 35 degree plus on a sustained basis day to day.
In a sense, in the summertime, you'll see we have thermal power plant failures after several days in those low to mid 30s, simply because our machines aren't quite designed to maintain a level of operation with those types of temperatures. Whereas what Josh has pointed out, Texas is built for 40 degree weather and can sustain that for a reasonably long time.
But, you know, there's sort of a cheap solution here, because if you had to, you could tell people to turn down their air conditioners. Nobody's going to die, really, if the air conditioners are turned down. But in Texas, if you knock off the heat, then people freeze to death.
Certainly, you're absolutely right. Shutting off your heat, well, that's going to result in the type of dire situation that ended up being happening. But dialing down your set point to, say, 19 degrees Celsius, something where you're conserving energy but still maintaining a level of adequate comfort, those are possibilities. So we do speak to that in the piece, is that the role that demand response could play. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is, first of all, most consumers are pretty inattentive to electricity prices. Other than maybe the four of us, most people don't really care about their usage or even probably know their price. So that's one. But the other is, by and large, actually in Alberta, no residential consumers face those real-time prices. And so we hit $1,000 a megawatt hour or $1 a kilowatt hour a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Yet I was still paying 5 cents. So there was no incentive for me to change any of my behavior, to dial down my set point. I have an electric vehicle, to change my charging pattern. So I'm still paying the 5 cents. When if we had that incentive to shift, I would gladly shift. And there's going to be a range of electrical usages where we have more flexibility in some versus others. We have some less discomfort changing our behavior in some versus others. So enabling the demand, I think, is a really important thing to look at as our supply gets more variable.
Well, and I think emission makes so much sense. And as we go towards electrifying everything, right, as more EVs hit the road and there's just greater electrification, it has to happen, right? Because we can't have all these EVs plugging in at 5 o'clock during peak time. This has been talked about for a long time. It seems like it makes sense, but it's very difficult to achieve. Like, what are the barriers?
There's three obstacles, and Josh, feel free to rein in after me, but first is technology. Actually, here in Alberta, we don't really have smart meters. So the bi-directional, hour-to-hour, real-time metering with communication between the house and the utility, we don't have that. So that's a starter. British Columbia does have that. I think in Texas, there's a large share of households that have that. So you need the technology. Second, you needed the reason to do it. So in historical times, when base load was relatively flat, power plants could dispatch easily, and you had small shares of variable energy, there wasn't a great impetus for shifting demand. Instead, we focused on shifting supply to match demand. So that's the second. But the third one is, at least at the residential level, there wasn't really big loads to manage. The biggest loads might be things like we talked about, heat, which is one you don't want to touch, air conditioner we could. But electric vehicles changes the game, because electric vehicle loads, you know, you can charge on a level two charger at a rate of 8 kilowatt, whereas a typical average draw on a household is 1 to 2. So these are big loads in the household. And like you point out, Jackie, having everybody charge at 5 p.m. is a huge burden on system peak. It's also a distribution problem. If you and I live on the same block and we both have EVs, three other folks on this same block have it, that becomes a local distribution challenge, and which can be overcome with cost. But it would be far more cost effective to have some sort of engineering solution where we're sequenced in our charging. And I should say lots of utilities are looking at that. Full disclosure, I'm working on a field experiment with a large utility doing exactly that, where you hand over some of the control of certain circuits in your house for the utility to manage when the draw occurs.
So we definitely looked at this in Texas. And because we've had large loads in houses, like 3 to 4 or 5 kilowatts for air conditioning, summer programs that have cycled thermostats, set them back. And we have the smart meters that allow that communication. It's something that we've done and have been relatively successful in terms of managing air conditioning loads and things. And the thing with EVs is you are adding fruit to the tree, but I think you're adding a pretty low hanging fruit, because a lot of these are connected by a 3G or cellular service doing over the air updates and things like that. We did an analysis in Texas where we actually just said, hey, what if all cars were EVs tomorrow? How would that work out for us? And we found that, like, with smart charging, if the utility could make sure you had enough energy to get whenever you needed it in the morning, that we could actually handle that with our current fleet. It would just be much more utilized, because the average capacity factor for a thermal generator over a typical day is maybe 40% or 60% or something like this. So there's plenty of room left, but Blake's right. It would make a distribution issue.
So, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, we've got the weather is becoming more volatile, extreme, or more, we'll call them black swan events. We've got our electrical power energy source mix changing to bring on significantly more renewable intermittent types of power. And on the demand side, we've got major potential changes in the load with things like electric vehicles and greater electrification. We probably will see more electric stoves and heaters and things like that. Do you sense that there is some sort of holistic thinking going on in terms of how we're going to accommodate all this stuff?
Well, when you think about the things you just raised there, in large part, they aren't a big challenge on that energy constraint, getting back to those two constraints I mentioned earlier. So EVs make more demands for energy over a quantum of time. Renewables add a big quantum of energy. And so, like Josh said, increasing our capacity factors on things can resolve that. Adding more renewables can resolve that. The real challenge is getting it when you need it. And so this is where the bulk of modeling is occurring. This is where the bulk of those planning on systems with increased electrification and increased shares of renewables are asking the tough questions, which is, how are we going to provide that firm, flexible, we use the term dispatchable, capacity in our systems? Kind of the four pillars. So demand response, so getting a more active demand, that's critical. There's lots of efforts there. Storage is one. Talked about it. It works really well in the intraday or hour to hour, but longer duration is a challenge. Transmission is another very promising one that pretty much any future of electricity model shows massive build out of what we call the macro grid, or large scale, long distance transmission to share resources where, you know, it's needed and not needed at the same time. And then the fourth one is low carbon firm resources. That's going to be a really important component, especially here in Alberta. We're going to be natural gas for the near term as that resource, but to get to lower levels of GHG emissions, it'll either be adding CCS to that natural gas, blending or completely shifting over to hydrogen in our turbines, or nuclear. So SMRs offer an option as well, but that is where the discussion's headed, Peter.
Yeah, that's where the discussion's headed. And we entered into this conversation, Blake, I think it was you that said, well, maybe it was Joshua, in Texas, on paper, everything looked like it should work, right? We had more capacity. But that's on paper. And all this stuff we're talking about is sort of theoretical. You know, in the soft world, these sort of extreme cases are called edge cases, or in more popular terms, the perfect storm, which we've seen. I guess, you know, all this stuff makes sense on paper, but how are we actually preparing ourselves for all these changes happening all at once in a relatively short period of time to accommodate these sorts of edge cases, perfect storms, whatever you want to call it?
Our grid was at an edge case all week last week, it seems like, at least down in Texas. You know, as we interconnect these different grids, these different loads, these different demands, we have to build the feedback mechanisms in them that we might not have seen before. Because, I mean, in Texas, all of the electricity folks assumed that the gas would get there, that they just assumed that they drew their box around their analysis. They just included the gas plant and didn't consider what the impacts would be on the gas system. Now, maybe they should have. You know, we did have some issues back in 2011 where they showed some of these vulnerabilities, but a lot of the recommendations were not made. I think it takes, you know, a multi-sector systems level analysis with also people who are down in the weeds to be able to answer those questions and then to try things and see what works. And not everything's going to work. I think it's important to try.
And one thing, too, will be revisiting assumptions. Remember back to the global financial crisis? Basically, you had the situation where all asset classes started correlating. Yeah. And so the previous correlations you thought were diversity was your strength broke down. And we saw a lot of that here, where you had the correlation of extreme demand correlating with supply failures across the fleet and the interdependency of the gas system and the power system. You know, a light shone on that. One good example is ERCOT does this winter reliability assessment just produced in November. First of all, they do a scenario of extreme load. We blew that out of the water. But the second is they do scenarios on outages. So they do an extreme scenario, sort of a 95th percentile of forced outages in the thermal fleet. That's one scenario they run. And separately, they do a scenario of very low wind power, so a fifth percentile of wind capacity. Yet they don't do one where they do them together. And that's what we saw. Yeah. We saw a correlation of low wind and extreme thermal outages. Yet that isn't one of the scenarios. So we need to think about where these correlations will come together in extreme events, because we are seeing more and more extreme events.
Now, is the simple solution then just to add these interconnects? We didn't talk much about that, but that was one of your recommendations, so that when all those events happen in one location, you can leverage, you know, extra generation somewhere else?
Simple would probably be a term I wouldn't use, because it won't be an easy solution to actually implement. But it does help you get out of that sort of correlative clutch of having everything move in the same direction together. If Texas had better connections with California, for example, during the crisis, there would have been some improvement, because California had balmy weather and relative surplus of electricity, at least generation at the time. Mm-hmm. Their gas market got affected simply by virtue of connectedness to the mid-continent. But building out the transmission grid is certainly a solution that looks extremely promising across North America to both deal with extreme weather challenges and help integrate more renewables at low cost. And most studies show that the build-out of transmission will result in lower cost electricity across North America. I say not simple because, as you guys know very well, building linear infrastructure anywhere is an extreme challenge. And in electricity, you're dealing with very different market structures. I mean, think of Alberta and BC and more connectedness between us. It's already a challenge at times. So increasing that will be in part a political and regulatory challenge more than any engineering one.
This has been a great conversation. We've learned a lot. The last line from your op-ed said, "One thing is certain, the events of this week," referring to last week, "will provide lessons for the electricity sector for years to come."
Well, thanks to both of you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.